It's all brought to you on WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. We are volunteer-operated, listener-supported community radio for East Central Illinois.
And one announcement here. Please consider supporting the programming that you love at WEFT. WEFT will gladly accept that vehicle you've been looking to get rid of. Our vehicle donation program provides an effortless option to support WEFT Community Radio. You can give Charitable Adult Rides and Services a call at 1-800-500-7433 or fill out the secure donation form at CareEasy, that's CareEasy.org. Just remember to designate WEFT as the nonprofit beneficiary of your gift. WEFT truly appreciates your support.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible in part by Bash Pepper Roofing. Large or small, they cover them all, commercial or residential. Bash Pepper Roofing offers roofing and re-roofing, gutters, siding, and door needs. For more information, 217-352-2200 or online at bashpepper.com.
Executive Director of Jewish Voices for Peace and currently co-director of Funding Freedom Project, raising money for solidarity projects. I didn't mention Rabbi Alisa Weiss is, I think, the lead organizer and co-founder of Rabbis for Ceasefire, having formerly been with Jewish Voices for Peace as well. They co-authored a book, Solidarity is the Political Version of Love, Lessons from Jewish Anti-Zionist Organizing. So there you have it, some provocative material for your Saturday morning listening. Tomorrow I'll also present a prepared program and I'll revisit something.
And this is WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM and streaming online at weft.org.
Mitch Jesuit.
And I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." And I saw, and behold, a white horse.
There's a man going round taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. The hairs on your arm will stand up at the terror in each sip and in each sup. Will you partake of that last offered cup or disappear into the potter's ground? When the a man who comes around. Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers. 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum. Voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. Till Armageddon, no shalom, no shalom. Then the father hen will call his chickens home. The wise men will bow down before the throne. And at his feet, they'll cast their golden crowns. When the man comes around. Whoever is unjust, let him be unjust still. Whoever is righteous, let him be righteous still. Whoever is filthy, let him be filthy still. Listen to the words long written down. When the man comes around. Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers. 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum. Voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. In measured hundredweight and penny pound. When the man comes around. On him was death, and hell followed with him.
WEFT, Champaign, Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio.
The show is Window on the World, where I look at items for your attention that are not... Today's show will feature mostly a long interview with Ilan Pape from the show Letters in Politics out of KPFA. They'll be talking about his book. book Lobbying for Zionism on Both Sides of the Atlantic. Opinions, of course, are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station.
I believe. He's threatening people taxed on imports. But where this stems from is that all the trade agreements that we've signed, there might be an exception, allow considerable latitude for the president to sort of unilaterally impose tariffs in, under various circumstances. There's also kind of a catch-all national defense provision that allows the president to impose tariffs for national defense reasons. Trump did that during his first term, imposed tariffs on Canada and Europe for national defense reasons. A little far-fetched. I'll just say, if we're at war with Canada, we got a real problem. But I guess currently with Trump, that's not an impossibility. But in any case, the president does have a lot of latitude. I suspect if Trump keeps going this way, it will be tested in court. But with the current structure of the Supreme Court, I would be surprised. I mean, given what they've been willing to rule in the past in Trump's favor, I'd be surprised. He's on better footing. I'll just put it this way. I'm not a lawyer, but he's on better footing with his tariffs than he has been on many other things where the courts rule in his favor.
Is the fixation on tariffs like purely a Trump phenomenon, or is there like some corner of right-wing or nationalist think tanks where this idea has been brewing?
Well, it is a Trump phenomenon in the extent he carries it. I really do think he doesn't understand who pays it. He's talking about having his Department of External Revenue, which is, the guy's creating a new bureaucracy as he talks about cutting down government bureaucracy. We already have an agency that collects the revenue from tariffs, and it's not external. It's what we pay at the ports. So I think a lot of this is his confusion, which is literally mind-boggling since it is front and center in his policy that he doesn't even know what it is. But there have been people, there certainly are some right-wingers who have supported tariffs. I've supported tariffs in the past. There are arguments for it. You could make an argument for protecting certain industries. That was what Biden was doing. He was trying to build up the clean energy industry. That meant China clearly has a big lead there. So if we're going to have a shot, you need to have protective tariffs, subsidies to try to get our industry up and running and be competitive. Also, there can be real national defense issues. I believe, and again, you could argue these, but it's a real story with the semiconductor industry. Most of our advanced semiconductors were coming from Taiwan, and in a context where we could have hostilities with China, hope we don't, but that's not inconceivable. Being dependent on advanced semiconductors from an island right offshore probably isn't really smart. So you could have them for that purpose. If you go back 25 years ago, when we had much more manufacturing in this country, and manufacturing workers got a wage premium, they were better paid than other workers with comparable education, comparably situated, you can make an argument that we want to protect our steel workers, we want to protect our auto workers, because these are good paying jobs, we don't want to see them go away. We didn't do that, and they went away. So there was, to my view, a reasonable argument as to why you wanted to have protection, say, 25, 30 years ago, because you were protecting good middle-class jobs that supported communities. Those jobs are gone now. The manufacturing wage premium has largely, if not completely, disappeared. So I don't think that's a coherent argument. So I think what we're seeing mostly is kind of silly nationalism and Trump's seeming, as they say, I don't know what the guy thinks in his head, but just going what he says. He thinks that we're making China pay the tariff. We're making Canada or Mexico or whoever pay the tariff. It's just higher prices for us. So anyhow, I think that's where this is coming from.
So in the scenario you outlined where a tariff is used to protect a domestic industry, you would either need a pre-existing domestic industry or a concurrent policy of subsidizing the development of one. Tariffs alone wouldn't do it.
It's hard to see that. Yeah. I mean, particularly in the world economy we have today where, you know, let's just take the auto industry, put up tariffs. I mean, you could put up ridiculously high tariffs. I don't know. Maybe we'll get to 100% so that anything that we import is going to be prohibitively. Actually, we have done that with China. So maybe I shouldn't treat that as being so impossible. But if you did that, of course, the implication is we could protect our industry, create jobs in that industry, and pay twice as much for our cars as everyone else in the world. That doesn't sound like a good policy to me, especially when we consider these are not going to be good union jobs. Again, this is one of the things important to drive home. If we go back to 1980, 40 years ago, I guess 45 now, the unionization rate in manufacturing was about a third, 33%. The rest of the private economy was 15%. So you could tell a story. Manufacturing jobs were good union jobs, because to a large extent that was true. Today, those numbers are 8% in manufacturing, 6% in the rest of the private sector. You can't tell the story that they're good union jobs. So if we did that Trump policy, I'm joking here, hopefully, 100% tariffs on all imported cars, then yeah, we could build up our auto industry some. We'll have jobs that aren't particularly well paying. So in effect, we'll be taxing retail workers, workers in healthcare, workers in other sectors by making them pay twice as much for cars. So we could shift some jobs from healthcare or whatever else to the auto sector. Why anyone would think that was a smart policy, I can't imagine.
So that's an interesting example, because it's one where the China tariffs to protect domestic industry would seem to be at odds with the threatened tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Like, to the extent there's a car industry left, it's a continental industry. Raw materials and parts move back and forth over the U.S. and Canadian and Mexican borders in really long supply chains. And if you're charging, you know, 25 cents when your iron ore comes back from Canada as steel, and 25% more when auto parts move in the other direction, suddenly it's going to get a lot more expensive to build cars here.
Absolutely. And it's really hard to understand what Trump hopes to accomplish this. I mean, with this, it's not very different than, suppose we said, hey, look at this. We have all these parts moving back and forth between Michigan and Ohio and Illinois. Why don't we tax them all as they go from one to the other and then back? That's what we would be doing. No one in their right mind would think that was a good policy. But that's, in effect, what Trump wants to do now in imposing big taxes on imports from Canada and Mexico.
Let's talk about the actual effects. You know, on the campaign trail, people attacking Trump for tariffs, like Elizabeth Warren, said these would be passed through, you know, on a one-to-one basis to consumers. That doesn't seem exactly right, right? The tariff would be on what the importer is paying. Usually the consumer markup is about a doubling of the wholesale price. So at a 25% tariff, even if it was fully passed through, wouldn't translate into a 25% price hike for a consumer.
Well, that's right. I don't know exactly Elizabeth Warren's words, but I'm sure she would agree with that. So the idea is that whatever the tariff is, it's, let's say we're imposing a tariff that adds $2,000 to the price of a car at the dock, then that $2,000 is what would be added to the price of the car at the consumer level. Now, maybe it's not exactly that, but somewhere in that ballpark. Now, maybe that's a 25% tariff at the dock, but it's a 12.5% increase when you or I go to the car lot to buy it. So that's right. But I'm not trying to defend or attack Elizabeth Warren, but I suspect you would completely agree with that.
Yeah. What, like, as an economic policy, how do tariffs work when they're well designed?
Well, when they're well designed, you can actually foster an industry, and you could point to success stories. So again, I've argued this, and then my friends have, that, you know, you could point to countries like Korea. South Korea used extensive tariffs to help develop an economy that went from really one of the poorest in the world. It's hard to believe South Korea back in 1960 was comparable in living standards to sub-Saharan Africa at the time. Today, its living standards are comparable to the middle of Europe. I don't know if quite the richest countries in Europe, but they're certainly up there with Italy, other countries in Europe. And a lot of that was they used protection to develop what they considered key industries. So you can do that, but it has to be part of a strategy. It's not so willy-nilly, we're just going to tariff everything, put taxes on everything in sight. That doesn't make any sense. And Korea was very mindful. We want to build up our auto industry. We want to build up our electronics industry. And they did it. So you can do that, but you need the coordinated policies to actually promote those industries, not just making things expensive to import.
So how does that stack up to the pronouncements we've gotten out of the Trump administration? What kind of consequences would you expect his proposed policies to have?
there's absolutely zero evidence of any sort of coordinated effort to promote certain industries. In fact, quite the opposite. I mean, so he's just announcing today or last night, I don't know, these weren't together, but yeah, big taxes on aluminum, on steel. These are inputs into production. So we're trying to build up the auto industry. So we're going to make steel more expensive. We're going to make aluminum more expensive. We're going to make semiconductors more expensive. That's not going to help your auto industry. So what industry exactly is he trying to build up? I mean, there might be one, but let me just put it this way. I wouldn't be able to tell you what it was. So again, if there's a coordinated policy, it really is hard to see it. And again, getting back to Biden, you could criticize and say he misjudged, it wasn't well executed, but he did have coordinated policies. He had subsidies for cars, electric vehicles, for solar panels. So those were accompanying the tariffs and also research and development in these areas. Trump is cutting those off. He just said, I don't like them. So, you know, what he's trying to do is very hard to understand. He's going to make us all pay more for this stuff. He'll cripple our industry. I can't figure out what he hopes to accomplish with it, you know, other than create chaos, which may be the point. I don't know if that's what he's trying to do, but that's likely what he will do.
So let's talk about like second order effects on international trade flows. This came up during like the 12-hour window before Colombian President Gustavo Petro backed down on allowing U.S. military flights to deport people directly to Colombia. Colombia is one of the few countries with which the United States enjoys a trade surplus. We export more to them than we import. And the idea was a strong tariff regime on Colombia might send that country, like much of the rest of the Southern Cone, into a much stronger trade relationship with China, which reportedly would not be good for U.S. national interests. If the U.S. becomes a tariff-happy company, does it just kind of take us out of international trade?
Absolutely. I mean, why on earth would anyone want to deal with a country where its president changes its policies depending on what the guy read on social media? I mean, you can't do business like that. And of course, that is how Trump did business before he became a reality TV show star. He broke his contracts. No one worked for him. They insist on being paid in advance. And a lot of people just wouldn't do business with him at all. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, also look at Mexico and Canada. He negotiated the deals that he's yelling about. So why would anyone do business with this guy? His commitments mean zero. So yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely certain Colombia and probably all of Latin America is now anxiously looking to China, probably Mexico and Canada also. I mean, why on earth, you know, do you want to do business with a nutball? So yes, I mean, this is, and also let me point out, people don't realize this. People call China the second largest economy. That's because they don't know the data. China's economy is already about a third larger than the U.S. economy, and it's growing more rapidly. So if you just go, oh, who do you want to have close ties to? Who's a good trading partner? You could have an economy that's at least relatively waning, where the U.S. isn't collapsing, although it might be, but it's declining relative to China. And it's completely erratic. So which one are you going to try and do business with? So I expect the whole world to be turning much more closely to China because, you know, again, the U.S. is just showing itself to be an erratic trading partner. It's not that anyone necessarily likes, see, and think the Chinese system's great, but that's not the question that a leader has to ask there. They have to say, who will allow for stable trading relations? And the answer is clearly China, because Trump is saying as clearly as possible, no, I'm nuts. I'll do whatever I feel like, and no one can stop me. And they'll go, good, go do it. And, you know, that's what we'll see.
All right, we're getting into an area of economics where I am most fuzzy. Trump goes on and on about trade deficits. So my understanding is that trade deficits balance out somehow. In the case of, say, U.S. and China, it's investment. China's government buys U.S. federal bonds, keeps the borrowing costs for our government low, keeps China's currency weak. Or you have capital flows, investments in U.S. companies balancing out the movement of goods the other direction. If there's like a sudden choke off in U.S. consumption from abroad, what happens on the other end of the ledger?
Well, presumably that means they're going to stop buying as much bonds or investing in other assets. So stock and flow, there's a difference here. So every year we have a trade deficit roughly $1 trillion. So what that means is that on net, foreign countries are investing $1 trillion here. That could be buying bonds, could be putting money in banks, they could be buying land, they could be investing in building factories. But in any case, that means by definition, literally accounting definitions, they must be putting $1 trillion into the U.S. on net. Now, if we put on huge tariffs and we stop buying the stuff, so our trade deficit went to zero, then the flip side would be they're buying less of our bonds, they're investing less in factories or whatever else. So that those were always equal to definition.
Is there a meaningful impact on the federal budget of the Trump administration getting tariff happy if they actually follow through on all their threats?
Well, it does. It's a big tax. I mean, so again, Trump doesn't seem to understand this. I have no idea what goes through his head. But if you impose these tariffs, if we're taxing our imports from Mexico 25%, taxing them from Canada 25%, whatever else in other countries, we're all paying more money in taxes. So yes, that goes to the federal budget. So, but again, you know, one of the things, again, he doesn't seem to understand, there's no way on earth he's talking about replacing the income tax with tariff revenue. We get around $2.5-3 trillion a year. I should double check that number, but somewhere in that order from the federal income tax. We import $4 trillion a year. So let's say we taxed it all 20%. That gets you $800 billion. That's nowhere near the amount we raise from the income tax. And I'll also add, if we tax it all 20%, we're going to import a lot less. So maybe instead of importing $4 trillion, we'd import $3 trillion. So then we get $600 billion with our 20% tariff. So these are not the same order of magnitude. So you can raise a lot of money with tariffs. It can be a big tax, and it's an incredibly regressive tax, you know. So it's one of these things. I wish I harangued people about this, that I wish the media just called it a tax on imports, because that is what it is. And a lot of people, and again, I think that includes Donald Trump, do not understand what a tariff is. So he's proposing big taxes on imports that is really going to be a hit to a typical worker's living standard.
So these tariffs that are like subject to an immense amount of executive discretion, are they something that the Congressional Budget Office can use in its scoring of, say, the next Republican proposal for a tax cut? Can they be used to make an income tax cut pencil out?
Well, they can't make it pencil out just because the numbers won't add up. But they can and will, and they should. You know, if Trump commits himself, again, a commitment from Trump, as we know, doesn't mean very much. But, you know, if he says we're going to have a 20% cross-the-board tariff, they will score 20% cross-the-board tariff. So they'll do just the arithmetic I just did. They say, okay, 20% tariff, our imports are going to fall from $4 trillion to $3 trillion. Those won't be the exact numbers, but they'll do something like that. So we'll raise $600 billion a year from that tariff. It won't cover the income tax.
Even if the tariff's not in the bill, it's just an executive order that could be reversed the day after the bill's passed?
They do current policy. So if Trump were to impose 20% tariffs, they will assume that policy will continue. You know, unless he specifically creates a deadline for it, say, oh, that's going to be in place for 6 months and then it will end. Then they would score it as being in place for 6 months and then ending.
So what do you think of the fact that the American right kind of pivoted on a dime in the age of Trump from being free trade, like frictionless border champions, to tariff champions?
Well, they're very opportunistic, and they realized that this was something that they could sell, and they did, again, with a lot of confusion. And I give them credit for being very politically astute. I give the Democrats enormous blame for being incredibly incompetent politically. But again, these are not principled. They want money. I mean, that's long and short. So they want their tax cuts. And if their way to get tax cuts is to say, oh, we're going to have big tariffs on everything in the world, they'll do that, because the bottom line is they want their tax cuts. It's as simple as that. Rich people need tax cuts. That should be the slogan of the Republican Party.
All right. Dean Baker, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean Baker is a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net, with Brian Edward Steekert from Upfront on tariffs and their vagaries. Now on to main feature interview with Brian Edward Steekert.
Take on adopting so JVP's history is, as there was attacks on Gaza, some headway on that ground, able to then
from Jewish anti-Zionism organizing. Again, the opinions are those of the speakers, necessarily shared by others at the station. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting.
We really had a first narrative hurdle to jump, which was to break this idea of consensus that all Jews support Israel, right? Once we were able to kind of make some headway on that ground, able to then coalesce as we grew, right? And it's important to acknowledge that our growth really maps on to Israeli aggression. So JVP's history is, as there was attacks on Gaza, the war on Lebanon, other events that galvanized people, we were kind of in a position of bringing in new people into the organization and then kind of reassessing kind of where we were politically after those crises abated. So the first thing that we did was take on adopting a position of support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And that was something that we did over a number of years. We engaged our members, some of whom were very ready to sign on and eager to do so very quickly. Others were very slow to kind of come around to the idea. But we went through a very engaged process where we created opportunities for people to meet in person in our national membership meetings to kind of discuss BDS. We did small group meetings locally in chapters and talked about the impact of signing that on their local organizing. And of course, was along the way really engaged with our Palestinian partners who gave us a lot of grace and a lot of room to go through this process in order to bring as many people with us, right, into our endorsement. So that process concluded with us signing on to the BDS call. And remarkably, very few people kind of left us in that. And in fact, more people joined the organization, kind of encouraged by the show of clarity and integrity of our political commitments. And then a few years later, it was another moment where, again, we were continuing to grow and in our power that we were able to use to confront Jewish institutions, elected officials, and others. And instead of what often happens in a lot of organizations is that you get to a certain size of sophistication and then you get to a place where you kind of feel like you're just treading water, trying to hold on to the power that you've amassed. What we understood is that we were building power in order to use it and to exert it and take it to the next level. So in our book, we talk about it as our organization was about growing while sharpening our politics. So the next horizon was to become an anti-Zionist organization. Many outside of the organization kind of already understood us as an anti-Zionist organization, but it felt important to us that we go through a process of integrity like we did with the BDS decision in order to give people an opportunity to really think it through strategically, politically, morally. And again, that was the same kind of conclusion where when we did come out and as an anti-Zionist organization, we had more people with us, right, than we did when we started that process, and very few people left. So really, it's a story of kind of organizing where we understand, and I think this is something that we need to highlight now in this political moment, because we are again in a time of mass mobilization in support of Palestine. And there are a lot of people who are, you know, kind of activating, right? That's the story of JVP. We've seen that happen over and over again in the face of Israeli aggression. I think this moment in its horror and immense cruelty of genocide is kind of an exceptional case. But it's also important to remember there's a lot of people that kind of, especially in the Jewish community, that are raised with certain ideas about allegiance and fidelity to Jewish community, which include Zionism, that are afraid about breaking and severing ties with family and friends and communities of origin. And so everybody, I think, needs to be given and afforded the support and encouragement to go through the process of being able to rethink things, look at a situation anew, and understand that they can evolve their thinking and their politics. Nobody comes into the world kind of like perfectly formed as a political thinker and organizer, right? And so as organizers, we have to do the work of supporting people in order to collectively assert power and force change from those that are reluctant to release it.
For a lot of people who grew up in Jewish community in the United States, Zionism is not like a carefully considered political position you arrive at. It's the water you grow up swimming in. And I wonder if you had conversations about whether being an explicitly anti-Zionist organization would foreclose on the opportunity to start a relationship with that kind of person and the dialogue that could bring them around to a different politics.
Yeah, that's exactly what that conversation and organizing process that Alyssa just described was about. And I think one of the things that was interesting about that process and actually very moving about that process was that even at the time, JVP then wasn't nearly as big as it is now, but even at the time we had tens of thousands of members and there were different constituencies within our membership. So like our rabbis, for example, who maybe were leading congregations, had very different investments in and responsibilities to their communities and people who they were in relationship with than our students maybe did, who were just starting out and had less of those ties. And there was everyone in between. The people who wanted to do legislative work, speaking to lawmakers, were thinking strategically differently than people were who were committed to action in the street. And the beautiful thing about JVP is that we encompassed, and JVP continues to encompass, all of those tactics. And so there had to be a balance of those things. Ultimately, and there are strategic questions about how to make sure that you can reach out to the people who are not quite there yet, which Alyssa just described, and having the political commitment. And that's where our conversations and commitments to our partners, in particular our Palestinian partners, made a huge difference. And so the process that we went through to become anti-Zionist was one where we ultimately decided that we could strategically make more of a difference by being the only Jewish organization of any size to become anti-Zionist, and that is actually still true. And by standing with our partners, it was also about the political context, which was that people were being accused and continue to be accused of being anti-Semitic when they're anti-Zionist. And by having a Jewish organization say loudly and proudly that we were anti-Zionist meant that we were giving some degree of cover to our Palestinian comrades and other comrades for whom the accusations of anti-Semitism that were coming at them were a result of them just narrating what their lives were like, because that's what the conversation was about, how anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is equivalent. So we felt that we could make a much bigger, not only did it match our political values, but we could make a much better strategic contribution, and that it was the right time to become an anti-Zionist organization. And like Alyssa said, the proof was really in the pudding, because we lost almost no members, and we brought a lot of new ones in because people appreciated our political clarity, our bravery, and our willingness to have real conversations about it. And it made a huge difference to our partners and our coalitional relationships and our ability to wage effective campaigns. And I think, again, after October 7th, it made a huge difference that JVP did not have to think about its political positioning. It was already clear. And so I really thank God every day that we had that conversation during a time when, before this moment that began on October 7th of last year, because it meant that JVP could really hit the ground running and do the incredible actions that it has been doing ever since October 7th to really, really make an impact on the ground. And that's the reflection of good organizing that Alyssa was talking about, that process, so that you're ready in those big moments because you've done the political education and the internal processes in the moments that are a little bit less overtly bringing in new people and are ready for those big moments and to bring new people in when they come.
But JVP wasn't the only highly visible Jewish organization participating in actions against the war in those early days. If not now, which I understand has had a more ambivalent relationship to anti-Zionism, was doing direct actions in the Capitol.
I was actually thinking about that as Rebecca was talking, was that one of the things that marked like our tenure, and Rebecca and my tenure as staff leaders at JVP, which was roughly from 2010 to 2021, is that when we began, we were kind of the only Jewish organization in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. But by the time we left, there was a much more robust Jewish ecosystem of anti-occupation organizations. If Not Now began around roughly 2014, the group Centered for Jewish Nonviolence, which does on-the-ground protective presence work in Israel-Palestine. And now even since then, there's been other organizations that have developed, and even pre-existing organizations that have been focused on domestic organizing that have expanded their analyses and political platforms, such as Jews for Racial Economic Justice in New York and a new Israeli anti-Zionist organization in the U.S. called Shoresh. So part of this has been that in the past decade or so, there's actually been a proliferation of Jewish organizing. And I, see that as a really good thing, right? It's like important that there's different ways for people to plug into the movement based on kind of either the identities they hold, whether that's Shoresh and you're an Israeli, or Rabbis for Ceasefire, you're a rabbi, or If Not Now when it began was for young people who came from being raised in legacy Jewish organizations and synagogues. So it feels important that there's, an understanding that there's a more vibrant movement ecosystem that has developed over this past decade, and which just demonstrates, you know, this moment where we're seeing like really a true rupture in American Jewish community is being able to be met with the force of all these organizations that have been growing and sprouting up over the past decade or so.
The voice you just heard is Rabbi Alyssa Weiss, currently lead organizer and co-founder of Rabbis for Ceasefire. Also with us, Rebecca Vilkemerson, former executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, now co-director of the Funding Freedom Project. They've co-authored the book Solidarity is the Political Version of Love, Lessons from Jewish Anti-Zionist Organizing, which is principally about their work with Jewish Voice for Peace. The organization was founded during the Second Intifada as a big tent organization, a home for Jews who felt some amount of solidarity with Palestinian struggle and didn't feel like they could express that within existing Jewish community organizations. As a big tent, Jewish Voice for Peace was not itself, at its inception, explicitly an anti-Zionist organization. One of the things the book deals with is the long process of internal dialogue and political education and organizing through which Jewish Voice for Peace first joined calls for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, and then became an explicitly anti-Zionist organization. Show is up front. My name's Brian Edwards Teeker. We're spending the hour with Rabbi Alyssa Weiss and Rebecca Vilkemerson. They've co-authored the book Solidarity is the Political Version of Love, Lessons from Jewish Anti-Zionist Organizing, which is principally about their experiences and leadership roles with Jewish Voice for Peace. Rabbi Alyssa Weiss is currently lead organizer and co-founder of Rabbis for Ceasefire. Rebecca Vilkemerson is former executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, now co-director of the Funding Freedom Project. That is an organization she co-leads with Palestinian organizer Soher Assad. Its work is focused on trying to build support for the Palestinian freedom struggle, specifically among donor networks and philanthropic organizations. Let's go back to the interview. I want to talk about being in coalition with Palestinian-led groups. You come to this work so that there's a Jewish face for anti-Zionism. You come to it knowing that because you're Jewish anti-Zionists, which is a bit of an oddity in the American imagination, you're going to get a lot of media coverage. Also because of all the privileges that attach to whiteness in the United States. I imagine you run the risk of kind of eclipsing any room that exists for actual Palestinians to get in front of cameras and speak for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, what you're raising is a tension that is live within JVP and has been really, I think, since the beginning. You know, I think that there's part of the kind of theory of JVP was that it's important to strategically, as Rebecca was saying earlier, to have a Jewish organization kind of be part of the mix of a Palestine freedom movement in order to kind of defang the way that Jews are used as a fig leaf and Jewish identity is used as a fig leaf for shielding Israel from war crimes. And accountability for their war crimes. So, you know, I think it's important to say that when we first kind of were getting started really being part of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, right, which is a different thing than being anti-occupation, right? There's plenty of organizations that can be against the occupation and critical of Israel, but not identify as part of the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And there was an incident pretty early on when I think we kind of were more fully kind of positioning ourselves in that way, actually that took place at University of California, Berkeley, when there was a student divestment hearing to divest from the Israeli occupation. And
this was among the ASUC, the student government.
Yeah, this was in 2010. And part of what happened then was that the JVP organizers, you know, thought it would be very strategic to kind of take the mic in the open comment section and be able to speak to kind of their support for the divestment resolution as Jews. And kind of thought it went pretty well. And then afterwards, we collected with the Palestinian organizers there, and who were pretty pissed and upset with how it went. And it felt like we were doing, as like it just became about kind of Jews who were against the divestment resolution and Jews that were for it. And actually the Palestinians didn't even get to say their full piece and kind of be heard, right? And that it actually did, it was actually a harm that we had done unintentionally, unwittingly to our Palestinian comrades, right? And that even if it might have been more strategic, right, there's also another element at play in these things of getting to have a venue where people can speak their truth to power, right, and have their experiences heard. And there's no one, you know, we learned from that experience. It's actually, you know, mistakes are actually gifts if you could make them that, because that happened very early on. We were able to learn that lesson. We, of course, made that mistake again and again because it's not a linear process, but we were able to kind of use that as a touch point like that to continue to kind of evolve, right? Like, I don't think that the goal is that we never make mistakes or slip ups, but that we learn from them and change how we move from that. And so even if we wouldn't make that exact mistake again, we would make one similar, right? Not intentionally, right? But I think that what was really essential in for us to figure out is how to be in actual real relationships and accountability, where we have relationships with Palestinian partners where they could give us that feedback, right? And where we could pre-talk about it ahead of time and be careful and ensure that it's set up in a different way, not to make those same mistakes. And I think there's always been a tension that for a long time, I'm not actually sure if this is true anymore, but for a long time, JVP was the biggest American Palestine solidarity organization, right? And that was an uncomfortable tension within the Palestine solidarity movement, right? And there were a lot of different efforts that we made during our tenure to kind of more carefully articulate our accountabilities to Palestinians on every level, whether it's on practical resources, on our relationships, on campaign setting, you know, and how do we embody, you kind of implement our commitment that Palestinians are the ones to set the political horizons for their liberation. And even those processes that we engaged in, where we were like, we're going to go set the, you know, go through a process and do interviews and come up with an articulation of our accountabilities, that also, and we detail this process in the book, where that also kind of was met with criticism and didn't kind of, we fell into some of the same traps that, you know, we had fallen in before, as far as were we setting it up properly so that everybody who were asking for feedback would feel comfortable to give us critical feedback. And I think that these kinds of tensions are not unique to the Palestine solidarity movement and Jews within it, right? I think you could map these kind of similar kind of tensions onto other movements. And I don't think that there's an easy answer, right? There's not like a simple remedy to offer, but I think the thing that I take from the experience is the importance of having the relationships to go back to, and that it's not a situation where you make one mistake and you're written off, right? But that the picture of how JVP moves and how we did is a complicated one. So sometimes we do the right, most of the time we're doing things that are to the benefit of and in accordance with our solidarity principles.
How did you define anti-Zionism internally?
We did write a very beautiful statement when we came out as anti-Zionist. And I think one thing that I think that I've been thinking as we've been talking that I feel like it's important to underscore is there have been Jewish anti-Zionists since the advent of Zionism. Right. There hasn't been a moment since the advent of the idea of political Zionism that there haven't been Jewish anti-Zionists. And those critiques and fissures in Zionism kind of span the complexity of Jewish identity. So there are those that refuse Zionism on the basis of religiosity, right? Ultra-Orthodox Jews who refuse the idea that humans can kind of repopulate historic Palestine. That's only something that can happen in messianic time. That's in God's hands. Then you had groups like the Jewish Labor Bund, which preferred to link arms with the working class where they were and make home where they lived, right? By nourishing, not dominating where they were. There were those that, like the Reform Movement of Judaism, which is still the largest liberal denomination in the U.S., was initially anti-Zionist, kind of eschewing the idea that Jews were a nation, right? And understanding Judaism solely as a religion, right? So there's always been Jewish anti-Zionism. And I think that's really important. I mean, Zionism is not inherent to Judaism or Jewishness, right? It was a political movement that began in the late 19th century. And in fact, the same year that the first World Zionist Congress took place, the first World Congress of the Jewish Labor Bund also took place. So there's been competing ideas within the Jewish world about Zionism from the beginning. And our statement around Zionism kind of was fed by all those different threads.
First, we define Zionism in the book as a settler colonial movement that successfully advocated for the establishment of a Jewish state in historic Palestine. While Zionism was hotly contested within Jewish communities when it first emerged in the late 1890s, since the mid-20th century, most Jewish institutions and a majority of Jews have seen Zionism as a movement of self-determination for the Jewish people. Zionism today is focused on maintaining a Jewish state through a violent, militarized apartheid system in which Jews have more rights than the indigenous Palestinian population. And then we define anti-Zionism as political opposition to Zionism based on our understanding of Zionism as a racist and settler colonial movement. And, you know, to Alyssa's point, also, we do have a very beautiful, JBP put together a very beautiful statement when we became anti-Zionist. And actually, it opens with a quote from the Jewish feminist Melanie K. Kantrowitz, which is what we took the title of the book from, which is Solidarity is the Political Version of Love. And so, you know, that was sort of the way that we were thinking about anti-Zionism, but we opened that statement by saying JVP is guided by a vision of justice, equality, and freedom for all people. And we unequivocally oppose Zionism because it is counter to those ideals.
Anti-Zionism by itself doesn't seem to offer people for whom Zionism had been part of their identity a different identity to attach to. Melanie K. Kantrowitz, I think, was the first to advance the idea of diasporism, making Jewishness an identity explicitly linked to existing in a geographically diffuse manner. How do you think about what the alternative for Jewish identity is?
Well, I know Alyssa will want to and should talk about that as a rabbi and as someone who's thinking about sort of the future of Judaism. But before I pass it to you, Alyssa, I wanted to just note that one of the most important themes that we draw out in the book and that I think is so crucial, not just to JVP's success, but to any movement that is trying to build a shifting narrative within its own community. So that could be Jews against Zionism, Hindus against Hindu nationalism, white people against white nationalism. All, you know, there's a lot of different communities that are trying to do the kind of organizing work that we've been doing, which is really involves confronting your own community in ways that are very, very costly. And so we think and talk a lot in the book, and we think and talk a lot in our organizing and in our campaign work about the concept of political home, and that our work is not just a collection of statements or political principles or ideologies. It is about being out on the streets and about campaign work and all those things, but it's also about building a sense of a new community, a place where you can bring your full self, a place where you feel seen and heard, and you can have your anti-Zionism, but you can also have, in our case, your Jewish practice, your Jewish ritual, your Jewish observance, where you feel like you can embody the Jewish values that you grew up in and fully embody your political self. And I really think if there's one thing I can say about JVP's growth and success as a movement and our organizing work and any movement's organizing work, it's if you build that sense of a political home for people.
I think that, you know, the work of political home building is so central to our assessment of kind of what has allowed JVP to thrive. We begin our book with an exploration of the strategies we used and the impact of those strategies on the kind of community we were able to build. And, you know, it relates to this question of kind of what else if not Zionism, right? It's not sufficient, right, for those of us who are interested in living our lives inside of Jewish time or connected to Jewish tradition or as Jews, however that looks, right? Because there's so many different ways that has looked over time throughout the world, right? And so what's important to me is to think about how do we ensure that there is something substantive, right, on the other side, right, of leaving Zionism, because of the ways that Zionism has been so successful to kind of become the centerpiece of Jewish identity for most American Jews, you know, it is a big ask, right? As an organizer, to tell people to like, to kind of go against your families of origin and your communities of origin in order to live with an alignment of with your values, right? And so it feels important that we create something where people can have something to identify with, right? And it's not like you abandon Zionism and then you fall off a cliff of like Jewish identity formation. And I do think that the idea of diasporism, right, which in my read is inherent to Judaism, like Judaism, from what I understand, is a tradition that was born by and for diaspora. So before we have the biblical period and the Torah, which is a foundational text that describes the period of the development and of Israelite religion. But it really wasn't until the destruction of the Second Temple and the Jewish dispersion from Jerusalem and historic Palestine that Judaism, as we know it, was developed. And so Judaism is a tradition that began in Babylonia and with the Babylonian Talmud and with the teachings of the early rabbis. And that was a tradition built by and for diaspora. And Jews have figured out how to make home alongside surrounding cultures. And sometimes, and for a lot of us in the United States, right, because most of the Jews in the United States are Ashkenazi, meaning from Eastern Europe, right? That story of making home alongside surrounding cultures was a pretty fraught and violent one. And for others around the world, there was a different story. Like Jews in the Middle East and North Africa had a different story of the way that they built community and camaraderie with their neighbors. So I think right now, there's a group of us that are thinking about how do we kind of establish diasporism more fully as a way to kind of understand one's Jewish identity that doesn't center around Israel or Zionism, right? That is independent of that and is still a scaffold for creating meaning, building community, being tethered to tradition, from that place, being able to take also meaningful political action in solidarity with the peoples you live among.
Rabbi Alyssa Wise, Rebecca Vilkermason, we should leave it there because I know your time is limited. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Rabbi Alyssa Wise is currently lead organizer and co-founder of Rabbis for Ceasefire. Rebecca Vilkermason is former executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace and now co-director of the Funding Freedom Project. They're co-authors of the book, Solidarity is the Political Version of Love, Lessons from Jewish Anti-Zionist Organizing.
Again, that was Rabbi Alyssa Wise, who's currently lead organizer and co-founder of Rabbis for Ceasefire. Rebecca Vilkermason is former executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace and now co-director of Funding Freedom Project. They've co-authored the book Solidarity is the Political Version of Love, Lessons from Jewish Anti-Zionist Organizing. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting. This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio.
WEFT Champaign, 90.1 through the FM airwaves. A little bit of static and whatnot thrown in there. Streaming through our website, weft.org. And, hey, there's a brand new way to listen to WEFT. You can still listen on 90.1 FM on the radio. You can also stream the station live on weft.org, but now you can listen from your mobile phone with the new WEFT app available for both iPhones and Android phones. Just go to the Apple Store or Google's Play Store and search for WEFT FM. Download the app and you can listen to WEFT live anytime from anywhere in the world. Plus, you can go back and listen to shows in the archives, discover recent playlists, find community information, make a donation, and even record a message or request and send it directly to WEFT. It's a whole new way to weft. Is Bob sitting in on Radio Free Labor today? Getting a little bit of an early start here, kind of, as filling in for some of Paul's stuff here. News from Neptune, his pre-recorded show. He's got some visitors in town or something happening this week. So, anyway, Radio Free Labor.